It is 4 o'clock on the East Coast, 1 in the Pacific. We are live. It is Monday, April 8th, coming to you from Studio Me here in Pittsburgh, PA. This is the Burn Pit Podcast. I am your host, Scott Benjamin Sieverts. To my right, as always, Matty Wack. Matty, what's up, brother?
What's going on, brother?
It is Monday. It's the best day of the week.
You're Yes, sir.
You're watching us on Spreely TV. Spreely is your home for free speech. It stands for Speak Freely. You can find Spreely on Roku, Apple TV, Fire Stick. You can also download the Freedom Hub app right to your phone or smart device. Go to Spreely.com. Sign up for Spreely Social. You can also go to Spreely Marketplace, a.k.a. America's Cost Club. They have a lot of great products on there, two of which we are sponsored by. Genesis Gold Group. Genesis Gold Group, a definitive gold guide to protect your IRA or 401k with physical gold or silver. You can complete a free form, and you can get your gold or silver guide on burnpitgold.com. Also, if you like clean water, which we all do, right? Century H2O. It's a water filtration company, German-engineered water filtration company. Century H2O. Use code BERMPIT, B-E-R-M-P-I-T. It's mycenturyh2o.com. Use BERMPIT for 15% off your order there today. Before we get started, I just want to apologize not only to the audience, but also to our guest today, E. Michael Jones. He should be joining us shortly. Not his fault. In the past, we've had issues that were out of our control. Guest was late, miscommunication. Today was our fault. We had some technical difficulties here. I apologize. But our guest today is going to be E. Michael Jones. He's joining us very shortly. Matt, if you wouldn't mind just giving a short little background while he comes on the Zoom on who E. Michael Jones is, just to set up, so maybe we can get by the initial introduction.
Yeah, so E. Michael Jones is he's the editor of Culture Wars magazine, culturewars.com. He is an experienced lecturer and speaker, and he actually speaks three different languages, including, obviously, English, German, and Spanish. He has a PhD from, I forget which college, St. Mary's College, I believe. He has multiple books that he has written, including Baron Metal, The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit, Libido Dominante, and his most latest book he has called The Holocaust Narrative. As soon as he joins us, we'll let him introduce himself, actually, because as we know, is what we usually do is we let our guests introduce themselves, because they can obviously introduce themselves better than anyone else can. So as soon as he gets on here, which is hopefully soon, we will let him speak to the listening, viewing audience. But
yeah, until then, you know, we missed a couple topics last week, and we had Anthony Lasacco. He's the author of The Analog Parent. We had him on live. He was really enjoyable to have, but we missed talking about a few topics, and while we're waiting for him to join, why don't we just touch on a couple of those?
Go ahead, shoot.
All right. Well, the Transgender Day of Visibility.
Oh, yeah.
That was an article that we touched on. Dominic Izzo and I also talked on that on his podcast on Wednesday. We were joined by another gentleman that's hosted a couple podcasts for us here, Matt Donovan. But he asked us about the Transgender Day Ability, and you know, there's that that thing that the left says a lot about white fragility. That's when you white people complain about something. That's, say, for instance, the Little Mermaid, right? The Little Mermaid got replaced. Mm-hmm. The actual character Ariel,
yeah,
got replaced by an African American woman for their show, and of course, there was some backlash there from people being like, you took a character that was made and was white, and then you made him black.
Yeah.
And then the black and leftists and feminists go, oh, why did you do that? You're complaining, you white fragility. You're you know, you're so sensitive. And Dominic Izzo, a friend of ours, also the Rants of Izzo's on here on Spreely TV, and we enjoy him thoroughly. But he said, you know, Christians are complaining. They're sensitive about things.
Yeah.
But you had a response. You called me after the show, and you had a response to Mr. Izzo.
Well, I didn't have a response to him. I mean, I'm not denying that maybe Christians are complaining. I mean, I guess they are. Do they have a legitimate excuse to complain?
They're complaining about, yes, bring them on in. But they were complaining. Anyways, we can get to it.
Yeah, we'll get to it later. We got E. Michael Jones joining us right now, I believe.
Yes. We owe him an apology real quick before we get into things. But it is quite an honor here to have this gentleman on. He's highly educated, and his opinion is extremely valued when it comes to, I mean, a lot of topics in history. If you haven't looked him up, there's some great videos on BitChute. He's a historian. I mean, he really is.
There he is.
Mr. Jones, how are you, sir?
Good. The confusion. I got two things on at the same time. Let me cancel this thing.
Okay. Take your time, sir.
Are we on now?
Yes, sir. We would just like to issue a sorry for being so late there. We apologize for the technical difficulties on our end. Mr. Jones was on time. He was ready to go. The issues were on our end, sir, so we apologize for that.
Okay, I can hear you now, but I don't see any audio video. Is that all right?
Can you see us now?
Can you hear us and see us, sir?
I can hear you, but I can't see you.
Okay. We'll work that on in the meantime. We did a brief introduction of you, sir, and the work that you've done. And Matt gave a brief introduction, but we normally like to allow the guest to give a brief introduction of themselves because no one can describe, you know, your work better than the man himself. So if you wouldn't mind taking a minute just to give a brief introduction for the listening viewing audience, those that may not know you, we're on Spreely TV. Here, it's a free speech network. And we're also on YouTube and Rumble and Spotify. But eventually, because of the topics that we discuss, we are prepared for the eventually be banned on those platforms. So Spreely, though, you can find on Roku, Apple, and Fire Stick. So speak freely here, sir. You can say whatever you want, and there'll be no edits, nothing like that. Again, thank you very much for your time today.
You're welcome. So I'm the editor of Culture Wars magazine. I started this about 40-some years ago when I basically got kicked out of academe. I started off to be a professor of American literature. Got a job at St. Mary's College, South Bend, Indiana, moved my family out here, and then got fired a year later for being against abortion at a Catholic college. So it was a kind of shock to me. The feminists had taken over the college, and I just had the sense that it was time to get out of academe. So I got into journalism at that point, and that's what I've been doing ever since. So I've written a number of books over these past 40 years, and I'm trying to refine my understanding of what's going on, because it's not clear what's going on. It hasn't been clear for a long time, because what we're dealing with is mass deception. In terms of the manipulation of our culture. So I think I've gotten a handle on it over this period of time, and I've written a number of books to deal with it, trying to explain it. So it depends on where you want to begin.
Well, sir, I was actually, this is Matt speaking. I actually wanted to get into your most recent book, which I know you started writing a while ago, and coincidentally, I think it came out kind of like at the perfect time. You know, this came out like, what, 6 months ago, 5 months ago, Dr. Jones?
Yeah, talking about the Holocaust narrative.
That's correct. That's correct. Now, for the listening and viewing audience, I want to let you know that this is E. Michael Jones's most recent book, and it's called The Holocaust Narrative. But if you can, Dr. Jones, explain what the Holocaust narrative is and how you describe it and how it pertains to our culture today.
Yeah, well, it's as I told you, I was trained in literary criticism, and wrote my dissertation on Nathaniel Hawthorne, American Literature, and I started to realize this is something that's all pervasive. Everybody, it's just a part of our culture. The government creates things called the Holocaust museums. They pay for them. The government pays for them. They're built all over the place, the big cities. It's just part of the culture. And it's the same. So you have to think about it, because this is what they want you to think about it. but you can't think about it at the same time, which means you have to accept their narrative, the narrative of the people who created the Holocaust Museum, this whole thing. And I thought, well, maybe there's a better way of looking at this. Why don't we just treat it like a literary artifact, like a genre? It certainly is a genre. There have been over 400 films made on the Holocaust, more than 400. Okay, so there's lots to talk about there. There are certain, and so, but the more I looked into it, I realized that there were certain seminal books that kind of created this narrative. It's all, it's a function of those books. And so it got started in World War II. Got started at the end of the war when the army, specifically General Eisenhower, shows up at a camp. The German defenses have collapsed, and so he shows up at a concentration camp. It's known as Ohrdruf, and nobody ever heard of it. Nobody talks about it anymore. There were all these dead bodies there. It's obvious there were dead bodies there. And so Eisenhower sees a moment of opportunity, calls in the press, calls in congressmen, gets a hold of the head of psychological warfare operation, Colonel McClure, General McClure, to basically, we're going to publicize this because the American soldier needs to know what he's fighting for. That's a direct quote from Eisenhower. So he calls them in, and now, so you've got those real bodies, the dead bodies, they're real. That's a category of reality. And then you impose a category of the mind on it, and this is basically how they died. Now, no one ever said there was a gas chamber in this place. So it's not a good place to use as the paradigm for the concentration camp. And so they decided to move on. They're not going to deal with Ohrdruf. They moved down the road to another concentration camp, which was called Buchenwald, which more people know about. And Eisenhower demanded that the mayor of Weimar, it's near Weimar in Germany, send 2,000 people basically to march them the 6 miles from Weimar to Buchenwald so that they can see what actually happened there. Well, now we got a different situation because the psychological warfare operation got there before the people and basically set up a show. The show was put on by a man by the name of C.D. Jackson, a very influential figure in psychological warfare, became Eisenhower's campaign manager, would go on to become a crucial player at both Time Magazine and the CIA, was basically working for both at the same time, which gives you some indication of the Time Magazine was the propaganda ministry of the CIA at that time, the 50s and 60s. And they got all these people there, and he holds up a lampshade, says the lampshade's made out of human skin. Some Jew got skinned. That's what the lampshade is. A pelvis ashtray and two shrunken heads. Now, why
and so
did
bright.
This? It's a kind of bizarre congeries of things that none of which had anything to do with the concentration camp. So give you a most obvious example, what are two shrunken heads doing there? Is someone claiming that Nazis used to shrink heads? No, they were taken from a museum because from some tribe in the Amazon because they do shrink heads down there. So this was an early attempt to create the narrative, and it's significant because none of that continued. It was a total failure, but it shows you that the psychological warfare operation was determined to create a story that would make simultaneously make the Germans look bad and exonerate the Allies at the same time from any war crimes that they had committed, and they had committed war crimes. So Eisenhower was guilty of starving German soldiers to death. He refused to declare them prisoners of war so that he wouldn't have to follow the Geneva Convention. So he just set up camps along the Rhine River, the Rhine Meadows, and they're called the Rheinwiesenlager. And they starved to death, or they died of exposure, or whatever. They died by the thousands. And no one knew about that. I lived in Germany for years. I taught a German school, German gymnasium. I was on the Rhine. I know what the Rhine meadows are. It's the floodplain for when the Rhine overflows. There was a camp of about 20 kilometers upstream in Rheinberg, and no one knew about it. I was there in the 70s. This story didn't come out until the 1990s, when a Canadian by the name of Bach wrote a book about it. So what you're talking about is the massive manipulation of events, guilt for political purposes. That's pretty much the beginning. So the man who filmed that was Billy Wilder. He was called in from Hollywood. He filmed it, and they did a film called Death Mills, Todesmühlen. And then the British did the same thing, except they did it in Bergen-Belsen.
Right.
So, and the man they got to film that was Alfred Hitchcock. The two famous Hollywood directors. Hitchcock was English, and so he filmed it for the British. They brought out a film. Now, Bergen-Belsen was an extraordinary situation, because there were lots of corpses in Bergen-Belsen. First of all, the place was overcrowded to begin with, and then as the Soviets were advancing from the east, the people in Auschwitz basically had a choice. The German commandant said, you can stay here and wait to be liberated by the Soviets, or you can fall back with us to another camp, Bergen-Belsen. So most of the people chose to go to Bergen-Belsen because the Soviet army had a terrible reputation at that point. And so it was extremely overcrowded, then to massively overcrowded, and the people were dying like flies because of typhus. And so this is the story that got developed over this period of time. And basically a narrative got created from these stories. Now, I remember as a child being shown pictures of Dachau. Dachau was the first concentration camp that was created. It was created in 1933, as soon as the Germans, as soon as the Nazis took power in Germany. And it was the paradigm. It was the paradigmatic camp. I remember it, saw the pictures, saw the dead bodies. Now, the unique thing about Dachau, and this came out in the book, is that it was for Catholics. There were thousands of Catholic priests there. There were so many Catholic priests that they had their own liturgy. They had people. The town I lived in Germany had a place called the Karl Leisnerheim, based a man by the name of Karl Leisner. He was not only in Dachau, he was ordained a priest in Dachau because they had bishops there and they could do that. And then he died shortly after that, and he died of tuberculosis. So you have people dying massively of the diseases that come about. There were no gas chambers in Dachau. The German government now says that there were no gas chambers in any concentration camp on German soil. Okay? So this
is... The German government admits that.
Yeah, the people there. There's a guy, someone wrote this up. It's an article. Basically, there's a guy, a Jew stands there, says he was in the gas chamber in Dachau, and they tolerate him because the Jews are allowed to say whatever they want, in Germany especially. But the official statement is, no, there was never a gas chamber in Dachau.
Yeah, now, so, Dr. Jones, real quick, I believe even Deborah Lipstadt or all the other people who, promote the Holocaust and are part of these Holocaust museums and Holocaust. They all openly admit that they believe Auschwitz, this is their standpoint, Auschwitz is the only one now to have claimed to have gas chambers. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, they're backing off. Yeah. Whether that's the only one, but they do claim that there were gas chambers at Dachau. Yeah, I'm sorry,
Auschwitz. Yeah,
but to get to the story here, okay, this is so one of the priests there at Dachau was an Austrian. There were a lot of Austrians dragged there. They basically the Nazis decapitated the entire Austrian government, dragged them all there. They were all Catholics. A lot of priests got dragged into Dachau from Austria. One of them was a guy named Johann Lenz. And he wrote a book after the war. okay? It's called Christus in Dachau. I read it in the original German, but it's been translated into English. Christ in Dachau. Sophia Press just issued a new edition of this, of the translation. You can get it on Amazon if you want to read it. But he wrote a story that it's not just a story. It's a story that has a meaning here. And so what is the meaning of Dachau, according to this priest? Basically, the priest said that the German people were being punished for the sin of godlessness. Nietzsche is kind of the classic example of German atheism. But he had infected a lot of people with his ideas. And these people hated God. And a lot of these people ended up being criminals. And then because of the labor shortage, a lot of these criminals simply got taken out of prison and put SS uniforms on them, and they got assigned as guards at Dachau. And the hatred of God got its focus on these priests because they were men of God, and they would torture them, and they killed a lot of them. But the main thing is that they were starving them to death. They were working him to death and starving him to death. And the priest said, we were completely helpless, and all we could do was pray. And at that point, at a certain point, he said, God heard our prayer. It was actually August 15th, Feast of the Assumption, 1942. He said, if we had gone another month, we all would have died of starvation and abuse and so on and so forth. But the word came down from Himmler, from the top, from Berlin. And said, basically, no, you can't starve these people to death. We need them to work. And so it changed. And at that point, they developed this liturgical life with all of these priests. And he said that the meaning of this is that suffering has a purpose. That God has a plan that allows suffering. And some people are called to suffer to expiate sin, which is precisely what Jesus Christ did when he died on the cross. Suffering is a central position in Christianity, central position. And he's saying that this Dachau affirmed that idea. Now, that was the idea of Dachau. That was the idea. That was the classic expression of the meaning of the concentration camps as of 1955 when that book came out. 3 years later, that narrative got hijacked. And the man who hijacked it was Elie Wiesel, and he wrote a book called Night. What I say in the book is that no, he didn't really write that book. The book came out originally in French, and it was called La Nuit, and the author was François Mauriac, who had already won the Nobel Prize. So, you know, he's a good writer in French. And he had this strange relationship with Elie Wiesel, who came up to him and kind of idolized him, but then started to manipulate him. Elie Wiesel, according to his account, wrote a memoir called in Yiddish called Und die Welt hat geschwiegen, and the world remained silent. And Mauriac took that and basically reworked it, cut about two-thirds of it away, took all of the stuff that was repugnant out of it, like Wiesel bragging about raping German girls and stuff like that, and created a new narrative with a new meaning. Now, the new meaning is basically, it's in the book, God died at Auschwitz. That's the new meaning. The complete opposite meaning of the one that Lentz and the Catholics created in Dachau. As of 1958, it took a while to get this thing started, but with the big Jewish control of the media behind it, it became the paradigmatic camp. Auschwitz became the paradigm. It replaced Dachau, and the new message is basically promotion of atheism. Okay, that is what it is. But the problem here is it goes even farther. I have 23 grandchildren. Okay,
wow.
Four of the oldest went to Catholic high school in Detroit. All four of them had to read Elie Wiesel's Night, and one of them had to read it twice. And so here you got a Catholic. This is not this is the rule, and it's not the exception. What you're seeing here is basically the Catholic Church using the Holocaust narrative, the hijacked narrative, okay, the one that Elie Wiesel created with François Mauriac's collaboration in order to promote atheism among Catholics. This is crazy. It's a disaster, and someone needs to bring it to an end. Why are you corrupting the minds of Catholic children with a completely bogus narrative? And I'm referring now specifically to Elie Wiesel's book. Now, the one thing that it does have in common with the narrative itself is that there is justification for the word Holocaust. Holocaust means burnt whole. Okay, and Elie Wiesel's testimony, this is, you read the book, you'll know what I'm talking about. When they show up in Auschwitz, they see these flames, and they're saying, look at the flames. That's where they were killing the Jews. He says, testifies that he saw Nazi guards throwing Jewish babies into these flaming pits. Okay, now the interesting about the Knight is he's always saying things like, I saw it with my own eyes, or was I dreaming? It's always like there's this, always this kind of hedging his bets. But that's what he said. Okay, there are no gas chambers in Elie Wiesel's Knight. Well, that would make him a Holocaust denier.
Yeah.
This, according to Debbie Lipstadt, said Debbie Lipstadt's the lady who created Holocaust denial as a criminal offense. She's now working for the Biden administration in this massive attempt to dragoon the entire U.S. government into fighting anti-Semitism, which means if you say something Debbie Lipstadt doesn't like, you've got to run a chance of going to jail. So this is the type of manipulation that has taken place over this period of time, and it created the Holocaust narrative. And the Holocaust narrative then is used as justification for criminal activity. And the main thing I'm talking about is the foundation of the State of Israel. It was founded with genocide. It was founded with ethnic cleansing. All you have to do is type in the Deir Yassin, what happened at that village. This is right at the time the people, the Stern Gang, these terrorists from Poland, Eastern Europe, came there, didn't grow up there. They came there and they basically started the extermination of the native people, the Palestinian people, which has continued to this day. And it's the crisis facing the world right now.
Yeah.
The genocide in Gaza and the inability of the United States government to stop Netanyahu from continuing on this regard.
They're funding it.
Pardon me?
I said they are funding it financially.
Absolutely. It couldn't go on without American bonds. Yep. So that means my taxpayer money is being used to basically support genocide. The word is out. There's no doubt that this is going on. The only doubt is whether the world opinion, whether the United Nations, whether anyone can stop this. But it goes back to the Holocaust. Yeah. The Holocaust allowed for the creation of Israel. Without the Holocaust, it wouldn't have happened.
Yeah. So let me ask you a question, Dr. Jones, because I've heard multiple people say this, including Brother Nathaniel, right? Alan Sabrowski. They said that the word Holocaust being used to describe the events of World War II into concentration camps didn't even exist until the late 60s, early 70s. Is that true?
Yes. Yeah.
Why did they wait that long in order to push that narrative?
Well, everything takes place over time.
Okay.
Everything I've written, every book I've written is based on the book I wrote before that. And so it builds up over time. And they try it, and then they run it up the flagpole, and they see if people salute it. And over this period of time, it's solidified around certain tropes, which I discuss in my book. And Holocaust, the term didn't really come into being in a widespread form until that miniseries called The Holocaust in the mid-70s. Now, my wife was teaching in public school in Philadelphia at that time, and it followed on Roots. Do you remember Roots?
Yeah. Yes, I do remember Kunta Roots. Kente.
Yes.
Yeah, so this was suddenly the idea of the miniseries caught on, and the Roots thing was huge because of the most of the students, not all the students where she taught, were Black. And it had this kind of electrifying effect on Black consciousness. And I think the Jews looked at it and said, hey, we got something powerful here. And they did the follow-up, and the follow-up was the Holocaust. That was the first time that the word was used in any basic sense. And everything takes time. Everything takes time. And at that point, that was the moment, and it got launched, and then it stuck. It makes more sense if you're talking about Elie Wiesel's book.
Yeah.
But then you got the conflict here between the other narrative that became the normative narrative, which was gas chambers. Well, the gas chambers don't lend themselves to the word Holocaust. The other thing that we have to bring in here is the fact that there was a real Holocaust at that point, but it was perpetrated by the Americans and the British, by the Air Force, and it was Dresden. The firebombing of Dresden and Hamburg were genuine Holocaust. They dropped napalm on city Dresden, which was full of refugees from the East. Nobody knows this. They were people, it was women and children. There was no military significance. It was a beautiful city. And at this point, it was just to terrorize the German population into submission.
Yeah.
So there may be that type of element involved here that you want to co-opt the term. You want exclusive rights to the term Holocaust. This is actually, that's not an exaggeration, because there's a film out called Defamation, made by an Israeli who goes to the headquarters of the Anti-Defamation League and tries to find out where the anti-Semitism is. His grandmother, Israeli grandmother, told him there's no such thing as anti-Semitism. So he goes there and tries and finds it out. He's having a hard time discovering it. But in that film, you see Abe Foxman, who seems benign compared to the current guy. Anyway, he goes to the Ukraine, which has also become significant, and he tells the Ukrainian government they're not allowed to use the word Holocaust or Holodomor to talk about the genocide by starvation that the Soviets imposed on. So they have a kind of proprietary right to this thing, and then they start using it. It gets more and more weaponized over a period of time.
Yes.
And it changes. I'm telling you, it changes. So the crucial moment here came in the 80s. A guy named Ernst Zundel, who was a Canadian, German, but he's living as a Canadian citizen.
Yeah.
He got hauled into court because he said that they're denied a lot of the fundamentals. Gas chambers are one of them. Big issue whether they were gas chambers or not. And so this is the only time there was a trial. This is significant, because a trial is something where you testify under oath. And when they got to the trial, the dean of Jewish historians was Raoul Hilberg, and he couldn't swear under oath that there was a final solution, that something had come out from there, and he couldn't swear under oath about the gas chambers. At that point, the narrative took a serious hit, and I'm saying that they had to adjust the narrative again. So at that point, Debbie Lipstadt, they stopped contesting, arguing with people, and Debbie Lipstadt, this is around 1991, 92, this is the reaction sets in. She says, all right, it's going to be illegal to dispute this. That's what Holocaust denial is, okay? And the other crucial thing that happened at around the same time, pretty much exactly the same time, is that Steven Spielberg starts to film Schindler's List.
Yeah.
So he goes to Poland, okay, and the word gets out, and everybody shows up at the film set and saying, I want to tell you my story. I got a story. I didn't happen to be. And Spielberg realizes at this point, if I listen to all these people, I'm never going to get the film done. So he creates something called the Shoah Foundation. And the Shoah Foundation basically exists to say, just give us your testimony. There was a shift at this point. I say that, so you don't have Raoul Hilberg. He was a historian. You're not conferring. That's not his bailiwick anymore. This is a new era, and basically everyone can tell their story, and no one's going to contest anything. And so you had absolutely crazy stories emerging at this point.
Yeah.
With no check, no reality right. check.
No, not to mention, Dr. Jones, during the Ernst Zundel trial, you also had Fred Leuchter in the Leuchter Report. And right after that, you had a Jewish man named David Cole go over and film a documentary interviewing Dr. Franciszek Pieper, along with filming the entire facility, and got the curator, Dr. Franciszek Pieper, admitting on camera that there were post-Soviet constructions done that they currently tell people that they are not. So they literally admit on camera that they lied to the tourists. But that being said, am I correct that right after the Leuchter report and Jewish David Cole going over there, that the Auschwitz Museum itself, or the Auschwitz facility itself, under Franciszek Pieper and the Polish government, is that when they reduced the death toll there from 4 million to 1 million?
Yeah, you're right. So, yes, they did reduce it then. So so you could go to jail if you said, you can go to jail now if you say 5,999,000, so on and so forth. But the official time got reduced from 4 million to 1.5 million. So it's constantly changing here. But you're right. The main change in Auschwitz took place right after the Soviet army arrived. So they closed it down and they retrofitted it to fit the narrative, and then they reopened it, and that's where the gas chamber thing came in.
And it was easy to do that because go ahead.
I'm saying that the trial. By the way, I started off to write the co-author this book with a retired professor of law in England, my name is John Beaumont, and he's a lawyer and I'm a literary critic, and it did not come together. So we did two separate books. So if you're interested in the legal, if you're interested in chemistry, you're interested into the Leuchter stuff, the legal right. stuff, that's his book. And that's right. The book is called The Truth Will Set You Free, The Case for Holocaust Revisionism, John Beaumont. And you can get it at fidelitypress.org, yep. which is also where you can get my book, The Holocaust Narrative.
I don't know if you can see, but I did purchase your book. I don't know if you could see or not, but I did purchase your book. I have it here in front of me.
Good.
Okay. I got it from Fidelity Press. Yeah.
That's right. That's where you get it. Don't go to Google. Don't go to Amazon, because this is contraband. I'm saying that they had to change the narrative in the light of Leuchter and Zundel.
Yeah.
So Debbie Lipstadt is one reaction. Basically, okay, it's criminal. We're not going to talk. We'll just throw you in jail. Forget it. And I actually tried, when we published in Culture Wars magazine, the first story by a French professor of French down in Georgia, University of Georgia, the fact that François Mauriac wrote Night and Elie Wiesel did not, she tried to get that guy destroyed. She tried to destroy that guy's career. And so she, you know, lied about him, and then she, they had an internal tribunal at the university, and he came through with flying colors, and he was not punished because everything he said was true. So that's the type of vindictive person that Debbie Lipstadt is, a piece of work. You don't want your life in Debbie Lipstadt's hands, okay? It's a bad idea. David Irving found that out.
Yep.
But, yeah, but I have a question, Dr. Jones. I have a quick question here. If the number got changed from 4 million to 1 million, they openly changed it, why then do we still have to accept the number as 6 million?
Good question. Ask Debbie Lipstadt. Don't ask me. that's precisely the point. I'm going to give you another much better instance here. But anyway, so Spielberg has to... It react to what happened with Leuchter and Zungel. So Schindler's List comes out, and one of the tropes that develops over this period of time is, you know, ladies, take off your clothes. So it became for porn. Ilga, She-Wolf of the SS. This became an integral part of the Holocaust narrative. And Schindler's List is softcore porn. The guy who noticed this was Howard Stern, because Schindler's List got played on network TV with all the nudity in it, and he couldn't get on that type of thing, so he was annoyed, so he brought it up. But anyway, so the trope is always take off your clothes, ladies. They march the naked ladies into the shower room, and guess what comes out of the shower head?
Water.
Water.
Steven Spielberg's a Holocaust denier.
Exactly. The point, Steven Spielberg is a Holocaust denier because he didn't have gas come out of the shower head. Schindler's List is Holocaust denial. Now, that's obviously not going to happen. Right. Okay, but this is precisely the situation that Debbie Lipstadt created. So as I told you, after the Shoah Foundation, it's anything goes. You can say whatever you want. And so one of the guys who decided that he was going to write a book is a guy named Benjamin Wilkomirski. And he wrote a book called Fragments. And this is about a Latvian. He's a Jew from Latvia, taken into a child's concentration camp. Okay? And it's just an incredibly touching story. And one of the people who was really touched by the story is none other than Debbie Lipstadt. And she starts promoting this book, and he becomes the face of the Holocaust. He became the next Elie Wiesel. That's what happened. She said that, someone said that. And so it's just an incredible story, except there's one problem here. There's no such person as Benjamin Wilkomirski. His real name is Dosiker. He's not a Jew. He's not from Latvia. He's a Jew from Switzerland. He's not a Jew. He's a Christian. He's an orphan who was raised by a wealthy family in Switzerland. Now, the story starts to come out, and Debbie Lipstadt goes into denial. Wait a minute. Is this Holocaust denial? And so she's teaching this thing, and the rumors keep spreading until finally a 60 Minutes gets involved. And as soon as 60 Minutes gets involved, they put him on camera, and the whole thing collapses like a house of cards. There is no Benjamin Wilkomirski. He made this, Dosiker made it all up. And the reason he got famous is because Debbie Lipstadt promoted it. Now, if you had said this, what I just said, before the 60 Minutes documentary, is that Holocaust denial? Well, yeah. And if Holocaust denial is illegal, you could have gone to jail for telling the truth that there was no Benjamin Wilkomirski. Because she held on to that. She, even after the 60 Minutes thing, she was teaching it. She was teaching this book. So that's the type of ridiculous. It's not ridiculous. It's worse than ridiculous. Because people their lives can be ruined for simply telling the truth about a lie. That's been, as long as the lie is called the Holocaust, then you can go to jail for opposing a lie. It got worse. Because if Mr. anything Jones, goes down, there's a lady in by the name of Mo. She's Misha DeFonest.
Okay, go ahead.
Misha DeFonseca, her parents get schlepped off to Auschwitz, and she's going to do something about it. A 9-year-old girl travels 900 miles across Europe in a pack of wolves to liberate her parents from Auschwitz. Now, that's an incredible story.
Well, if you don't believe it, you're a Holocaust denier.
Well, the point is that she, okay, once again, her name is not Misha DeFonseca. It's Monique DeVale. She's not a Jew. She's a Belgian Catholic. And I know you'll find this hard to believe. She didn't travel in a pack of wolves.
Dr. Jones, I'm sorry to interrupt here. Our hour ends at 5 o'clock. I apologize for the late start again, everybody. You're watching us on Spreely TV. We have Dr. E. Michael Jones with us today, a great guest. Before we get out of here, I have one last question to ask you, and it has to do with evangelical Christians and Catholics. But also, I'd like to extend you an invitation. Anytime you'd like to join the show, even next Monday, if you'd like to join us again, we have Dr. Alan Zabrowski joining the Zoom as well. And I promise you we can get these technical difficulties that we dealt with today, we can get those fixed and have it ready. If you'd like to join us, you have the Zoom link now. You can join us if you'd like to.
Yeah, because we definitely wanted to have you back on again because there's a ton more to talk about.
We should do a recorded episode where there's hours. We could talk to you for hours, sir, about
there's
all this.
Lots to talk about here. It's really important because everything, this whole genocide in Gaza right there, no one can do anything about it. It's all based on the Holocaust. That is the license they have to murder anybody they want. As soon as they say the Holocaust, then they're all free. That's a get out of jail card, the universal get out of jail card. This is a crisis for the entire world right now. Do we believe that certain people have the right to kill innocent women and children with impunity because they said they have relatives who died in the Holocaust?
Yeah,
36 hospitals. 36 hospitals have been bombed in Gaza. 36.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty disgusting. And real quick, Doctor, because he's going to ask you a question, but Dr. Jones, I just want your opinion real quick on what you think is going to happen in America, because now you have multiple states, I believe 29, with just broad hate speech laws, but you have Governor DeSantis who went over to Israel to sign an anti-Semitism law. Now you have Governor Abbott who signed an anti-Semitism executive order in Texas.
Governor of South Dakota.
And now the governor of South Dakota, Kristi Noem, signed an anti-Semitism bill. How far do you believe this is going to go in America before people start going to prison just for questioning this historical event?
It's not going to go there. It's not going to work. These are going to be appealed. They will go to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court will strike down every single one of these laws as violations of the First Amendment. Okay, that's what's going to happen. If I'm placing a bet, I'm going to place a bet that is going to happen. If it doesn't happen, then it's the end of America, because we don't have anything other than free speech here. We don't have a culture. We don't have an established religion. This is what it means to be an American, and that's why I can write this book over here, and I couldn't write it in Germany. I'm saying it's going to happen. They're all going to be struck down as violations of the First Amendment.
My question is, I grew up in a Christian family. My mom is a professor here in Beaver Falls, PA, at Geneva College. She's a college professor for a Christian. She does literature, English. My dad was a Christian. They're born again Christians. What do you say to, and I felt this way for a while, and until you start looking into the truth and you open your eyes a little bit, what do you say to those Christians, especially in the boomer generation and X, that those verses in the Old Testament in Genesis, Deuteronomy, those who bless my people, I will bless; those who curse my people, I will curse. They're God's chosen people. We have to pray for Israel. It's almost as Israel's interests get put in front of the United States' interests. The Jews are put in front of the Christians. The Christians have adopted this narrative that they have to bless these people. They have to donate to Israel. They have to all this stuff. How do you change that mindset on a person? How do you address that? And I've talked to my father about this, and he gets to the point where he's upset. Like, he's upset. He's called me, Scott, are you becoming an anti-Semite? Are you anti-Semitic now? What's happening here? You know, it's I'm just bringing some information to him, and he's very uncomfortable with it. I don't know how you, if you have any advice for me or guidance, how do you change that narrative?
Okay. First of all, you're talking about the Scofield Bible. That is why evangelicals believe what they believe. And this was a guy, a con man, but it would have gone nowhere, but he linked up with the Untermeyer family in New York, very influential Jewish family there. And they got the Oxford University Press to bring out this Bible with the Scofield Notes, which basically says that, you know, those people we call Jews there, they're the children of Moses. Well, if you read the Gospel of St. John, which we did read just this past week because it's Christmas, because it's Easter.
Easter.
Okay, there's a confrontation between the Jews and Jesus Christ. And Jesus Christ, they say to him, they're racists. These Jews are racist. They say, we are the seed of Abraham. And Jesus Christ says to him, God doesn't need your DNA. That's not exactly what he says. God could raise up stones. He doesn't need you.
That's right. He did say that.
If you were a child of Moses, you would accept me because Moses waited for this. And at that point, the Jews turn and they decide they're going to kill him. Okay? This is the fundamental turning point of human history. Okay? When the Messiah finally arrives and the Jewish people have to decide, are we going to accept him on his terms or not? And they did not. Now, no Christian can deny this. Okay? True. The Jews killed Christ. St. Paul said that in 1 Thessalonians 2. The Jews are the people that killed Christ, and they are enemies of the entire human race. Now, that's what happened then. Okay, there's no way around that. That means that we as Christians are the new Israel. We are the children of God. We are the children of Moses. We are the new Israel. We are the successors. That covenant is over. The Mosaic covenant is over. The veil was rent at the time of the crucifixion, and if they didn't get the memo at that point, the Roman Empire came and destroyed the temple in 70 AD. They have no priesthood, no sacrifice. They cannot fulfill the Mosaic covenant. They have no special status anymore. If they want to be saved, they have to get baptized. And that is precisely what Peter says at the beginning of the Acts of the Apostles. This is after Pentecost. They were fear of the Jews, and they were hiding in the room, and then suddenly the Holy Spirit comes, and now they're full of zeal, and he walks back into Jerusalem, and he says, you killed Christ.
Hmm.
And the Jews are struck, cut to the heart. And at that point, they say, what must we do to be saved? And he said, you must be baptized. Now, all of that has been turned on its head by this so-called Scofield Bible. And this is the main problem among evangelicals. Catholic Church has its own problems. I could talk about that too. But I mean, this is the main problem among evangelicals. And I worked with these people. I worked with Pat Robertson the 90s. Okay, I'm trying to bring this, Catholics and evangelicals together so we can put an end to abortions, that type of thing. I suddenly realized, wait a minute, this guy's working for the Jews. That's what he's doing. And if that wasn't obvious, then we had Jerry Falwell.
And John Heggie. Yeah,
he's so good, man.
John Heggie's the worst.
This is so good, Dr. Jones. You're great.
And this is so Jerry Falwell comes to Notre Dame, and I'm living down the street here, and he shows up and he's giving a speech, and he announces that he just flew in on a jet. It's Menachem Begum gave him that jet, and now he's flying around spreading the gospel of Israel. That's how you get rich and famous if you want to be a preacher, and that's the Achilles heel of the evangelicals right now, that they're all proxy warriors. Israel. I have a son who lives in Oklahoma. He introduced me to his friends. These are young guys from Oklahoma. Oklahoma is 100% pro-life and 100% pro-Zionist.
Hmm.
So the kid, I said, did you know that Israelis are Jews? Did you know that? Did you know there's a common denominator here? You know? So how is it okay you know that abortion's wrong, okay? Well, why is it okay to kill babies with F-16s? You have to bring this thing together. We have to bring this thing together because this is the fundamental problem with our culture right now. And I don't want to keep you. I know you guys have things to do, but there's something just happened very significant just a week ago, and it was this battle between Candace Owen and Ben Shapiro.
Yep.
Ben Shapiro claimed to be a conservative. Okay, there's one basis for conservatism, and there's one basis for America. And Irving Kristol said it. He's a Jew. He's the guy who created the neoconservative movement. It's called Judeo-Christian morality. Judeo-Christian morality. Well, okay, you tell me now, what's the Judeo-Christian position on abortion? What happened this past 2 years ago is that Roe versus Wade gets overturned immediately, not immediately, but over a period of the next couple of weeks, 400 Jewish organizations say that abortion is a fundamental Jewish value. We have no unity anymore. There's no unity anymore.
Dr. Jones.
That's conservatism. And that's all that Candace Owens said. So the rabbi's trying to berate her, telling her she's an anti-Semite. And she says, wait a minute, you can't impose your religion on me. That's the fundamental turning point. And I don't care how much Ben Shapiro has, you can't bring back this Judeo-Christian morality because Ben Shapiro killed it. He killed it by the way he reacted to what happened in Gaza. That's not conservative. That's Zionist propaganda.
Yep.
That's it. It's over.
Well, he got caught showing a picture of a burnt baby that was AI generated. He never apologized for it. But my question to you is, Dr. Jones, because there's so much control in discourse from Zionists, and that's Zionist Jews, Zionist Christians, do you believe that because this Candace Owens, the Kyrie Irvings, the Kanye Wests,
Jake Shields,
you have an overwhelming amount of people now being pro-Palestine, not only in America but across the world. More people are coming out. Even Patrick Bet-David talking about not funding Israel and how this Jewish power is starting to have a little bit of they're talking negatively about the genocide in Palestine. There's more and more people speaking up. Do you think that the Zionists are going to push harder and try and take more control, or do you believe they're overplaying their hand and they're going to fade away and just wither out in a puff or whatever? What do you think is going to happen? Do you think they're going to press harder, or do you think they're just going to wither away?
Well, it's going to have both. It's both going to happen. So if you overplay your hand, everything you do is counterproductive. So you're going to overplay your hand. What are you going to do? More bombs on those Palestinians? You're turning everybody in the world against you. It shows up in the United Nations when they try to get some type of ceasefire. The entire world votes for a ceasefire, and four groups don't. United States, Israel, Nauru. Yep. Micronesia, can you locate Nauru on a map?
No, I couldn't, no.
It's a big pile of bird shit in the middle of the Pacific Ocean.
Well, Dr. Jones, go ahead, Scotty.
One more thing, I'm sorry. My dad, again, is a 76-year-old man. He's a retired teacher, and he has used the book of Deuteronomy. There's a verse where God tells the Israelites to go into the land of Canaan and kill all the women, the children, the livestock, all of it. And these Christians today that are pro-Israel and on the side of Israel are using that instance in the Old Testament as saying, well, they're enemies of God. This is justified. This is justified. What they're doing, Hamas is a terror organization. It's justified. In Deuteronomy, God had commanded them to go in and kill the women, the children, even the livestock, kill them. So this is what the Israelites are carrying out, God's will here. It's disgusting, really. It's sick is what it is. They bought into this, and I don't know how to talk to a lot of my aunts, uncles, even the evangelical that raised me. I don't know how to address this stuff or change them. I don't think I can. I don't think I can change them. I don't know.
Try quoting scripture. Try reading the Gospel of St. John.
Yeah.
Ask them what they think of 1 Thessalonians 2. Do they disagree with St. Paul? I mean, if you're going to deal with it from Scripture, there's plenty of evidence. And then the second is, of course you're right. You're absolutely right. Netanyahu has said these Palestinians are Amalek. That's exactly what he's referring to.
Yeah.
The commission. So who gave this? Do you know where? Do you know I went to high school a mile away from Benjamin Netanyahu, where he went to high school?
Wow.
Really?
Did you? Am I an Israeli? No, I'm not an Israeli. So what gave this Philadelphian the right to say that these Palestinians are Amalek? Who is he? Is he Joshua? I mean, maybe, right. I'm not denying that God told Joshua certain things, But to say that these people are the children of Moses is wrong.
Yeah.
Is wrong. That's not. They have no right to call themselves the children of Moses. Jesus Christ gets the right to tell you whether you're a child of Moses. And Jesus Christ never invoked the word Amalek. That's over. That's over. And they have no right to do it. And if they think they have a right to do it, they have no right to exist. The Zionist regime has no right to exist. Who said they did? Does the Republican Party have a divine right to exist? No.
I'll tell you why Israel has a right to exist, because somebody took a picture of a pile of shoes.
Man, you're back to the Holocaust narrative, and that's exactly.
Again, thanks, folks, for watching us every Monday here live on Spreeley TV, 1 o'clock. Again, we apologize for the technical difficulties today. This is the Burn Pit Podcast. I'm Scott Benjamin Sieverts. To my right, as always, Matty Wack. Thank you again to Dr. E. Michael Jones for joining us today. I hope to get him back on. It would be great to have him and Alan Zabrowski on next Monday together. Those two gentlemen together would be fantastic. But thank you again to the guests. Our apologies again. Thank you, Studio Me. Thank you, Peter J.S. Regan, our producer. Folks, hope you enjoy. We'll see you next Monday and every Monday after that. We're out of here. Thank you for taking the time to watch us. If you like this episode and you'd like to watch another one, click here. Don't forget to like and subscribe. Thanks.